Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories for this very special interview with Richard Dutcher, the father of Mormon cinema. I'm John DeLynn. Please bear with me while I make four short but very important announcements with regard to this interview. First, these interviews are not only available in audio format, they're also available in high-definition video with footage from Richard's actual movies at youtube.com/mormonstories. Please check them out if you can. They're quite amazing. Historical, even. Second, Richard is in critical need of support for his current film project called Triptych, so please visit the website kickstarter.com during the month of October 2010 to donate. Kickstarter is a site created to help fund creative endeavors, but it requires that the funding target be completely raised before any funds change hands. Each project is given a particular number of days to reach its funding goals. In this case, it's 30 days, so time is of the essence. To learn more about the Triptych project, listen to this full interview or visit the site and type in Triptych. Triptych is spelled T-R-I-P-T-Y-C-H and or Richard Dutcher. That's kickstarter.com, K-I-C-K-starter.com. We will also have a link to Richard's Triptych fundraising page at richarddutcher.com. For those of you who do not own Richard Dutcher's movies, such as God's Army, Brigham City, or States of Grace, please consider supporting Richard's incredible filmmaking by buying the DVDs today at richarddutcher.com. That's D-U-T-C-H-E-R. These movies are fantastic, and you will enjoy these Mormon Stories interviews so much more if you've actually seen the movies. I can't recommend these movies highly enough. Finally, if you'd like to make a gift or investment to help Richard with one of his much larger film projects, including his much-discussed Joseph Smith movie, please contact him through richarddutcher.com or via Facebook. Again, the last name is spelled D-U-T-C-H-E-R. Let's do our part to help him make that Joseph Smith movie. It's his birthright. Thanks again for listening, and now on with the show. Take it away, Dan Witherspoon.
Welcome, everybody, to Mormon Stories. My name is Dan Witherspoon. For those of you who have been following recent developments on the Mormon Stories podcast, John DeLynn has asked me, as well as someone, a Mormon therapist and psychologist named Natasha Parker, to begin producing some of the content that will be on Mormon Stories podcast. So I'm grateful for this chance to meet with you. I've actually done a few interviews with other people, but this will be the first one of mine that airs, and I'm grateful to have it, and I'm very excited to have a guest, and I know that many of you listeners are too. When we announced that our guest today would be Richard Dutcher, quite a few of you wrote in with questions that you were hoping that we'd cover. For those who've never heard of Richard Dutcher, he is considered by many the father of Mormon cinema. It was almost exactly 10 years ago that his movie God's Army first hit the scene and sort of created this phenomenon that many other LDS filmmakers jumped into the game of producing films that dealt with Mormon characters in Mormon settings and were geared towards the Mormon audience. Richard himself produced, besides God's Army, two other films that were specifically, well, probably three if you count Falling, but he produced and directed, and he basically did everything for a film called Brigham City, as well as he did God's Army 2, which is also sometimes known better as States of Grace. He also then did a film called Falling, and so all these would be within that genre of Mormon cinema. But for many of you who know him or have been familiar at all, Richard's also known somewhat for having backed away a little bit from what he created in the terms of Mormon cinema. He's hasn't always felt comfortable with the direction that some of the filmmakers have taken this art form, and some of the ideals that he had going into Mormon cinema haven't been there. So we're excited that he's going to talk with us today about all those issues. Our plan today for the podcast is to start at the beginning of Richard's life, take him up through all of his formative experiences, get him into film school, get him into this to be a married man, and deciding on a career as an independent filmmaker, the different directions that you can go when you come out of film school. He chose to make independent films, to write and direct and shoot his own scripts. So we'll get into all that. Then we hope that Richard will be willing to talk thoroughly about each of his films. Following that, we're going to delve into as much of his spiritual journey, and especially his relationship with Mormonism that's evolved through the years. And then we will talk about the future of Mormon cinema, advice to filmmakers and things like that, and then we'll close by really trying to figure out what you're, and hear the news of what you're doing now, Richard.
Right.
We were talking a little bit. Let me go ahead right now and give you the scoop on what Richard's doing now, and we're hopefully that. But right now, Richard is filming a new film called Triptych. You can get his other movies, especially God's Army, Brigham City, and States of Grace, through MainStreetMovieCompany.com. MovieCo.com. Good.
Right.
And then also RichardDutcher.com. So if you were interested in that, and we'll talk about the box set and other options as we go. So those are the ways to get what he's doing. But right now, his film Triptych is being filmed. You can learn about it if you just do a Google search for Richard Dutcher and Triptych. And also, if you go to Kickstarter.com, and would you just kick in, what would you say
yeah,
there?
Yeah, Kickstarter.com is a site where you can make donations. So if anyone's interested in helping me get this film made, and we'll talk more about it later, but that's a great way to help out, to be a part of it.
And then at the end of the our podcast interview, we'll talk more about it. But if you'd like to help Richard in a big, big way, if you throw a major donation or something like that, you can also contact him through MainStreetMovieCo.com, or you can find him at Main Street Movie Company on Facebook. So
right,
good,
great.
Okay, so we're gonna go ahead and, well, first of all, welcome Richard to Mormon Stories.
Thank you, Dan. It's nice to do this.
You've been somewhat familiar. I mean, early in 2007, you at least answered some questions from people that were at Mormon Stories, and so
right.
you're familiar with it and stuff, but this is the first time we've been able to really land you as a guest.
Right.
I know you and I did an interview right after States of Grace came out, that we did it through the Sunstone podcast. I was the editor of Sunstone for a while, and you
right.
agreed to come on, and John DeLynn was on that interview too, and I know that he's released it as a link or something through Mormon Stories too, so
people might
be aware of that. Let's begin with the beginning of your life. Where were you born? Tell me about your family. Tell me about your upbringing that stuff. And I'll interrupt you.
Yeah, make this somewhat interesting. I was born in Chicago, Illinois, to a non-Mormon family, and. I should probably say why I laugh. My dad was a short order cook in Chicago, and my mom was worked at a heating supply company, and they met at his restaurant and hit it off, and I was the result of that. So I grew up. We moved away from Chicago shortly thereafter and went to Southern Illinois. That's where my early childhood was. And crazy childhood. My dad was a bartender, so most of my... And it wasn't a happy marriage, and so it was a very volatile marriage. And besides being a bartender, he was also an alcoholic and liked women quite a bit. But some early memories were, you know, for me, riding around the bar where he worked. He had a little big wheel there for me. So while he was prepping the bar for the weekend, I would be riding among the tables and playing the jukebox and all the little games and stuff like that. And it was nice memories, you know, I'd get soda and peanuts and just had a great time. But then my parents divorced when I was about six, and my mother shortly thereafter started dating a businessman who came through town whose name was Harold Dutcher. And he was Mormon, and so that relationship kind of kicked off. And interestingly enough, how that kind of relates to all of this is that I hadn't seen a film in a movie theater at all during my childhood. For one reason, we didn't have a lot of money, and the other reason was that my mother's side of the family was Pentecostal, and movies were definitely out. You know, you could watch television all you wanted to, but for some reason, movies, going to the movie theater was not acceptable. So I never got to actually see a movie in a theater. And then my father's side of the family was Baptist. And so that was kind of my religious background. And so when Harold Dutcher came around, one of the things he wanted to do, you know, he thought, you know, a good way to win over the kids would be to take them to a movie or whatever. And so I saw my first film there. It was Mount Vernon, Illinois. And I was tracking this recently, and it turned out that my It's very memorable, but my first film was a John Wayne movie. It was called The Cowboys.
Oh.
And I remember just being absolutely enthralled. You know, I was a little kid sitting in this huge, it was one of those old style movie theaters, you know, probably 600, 800 seats in it. And watching this great movie, and then, you know, as we left the theater, it was just in my mind, and I just pretty much knew immediately that that's what I wanted to do. I didn't know how it was done. I didn't know, you know, how, never occurred to me that someone could actually make a living doing that, you know, making films. But I knew I basically had fallen in love that day with movies, and it's never gone away. So that's the earliest childhood. And then we moved around a lot. He was a businessman, and so he would go out and raise money, and he had a scaffolding company and a ladder company and various things over the years, and got into oil drilling. And so I grew up around all of that, we lived in Wisconsin and Kentucky and Kansas, and ended up in Utah for my high school years. And
which high school?
Went to Hillcrest High School, Salt Lake City.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's that.
Okay. Any other aspects of your childhood or anything you want to bring up? So at some point, after the divorce with your biological father, your mom, did she come to you and say, do you want to take Harold's last name? So when did you become Richard Dutcher? And
as a 6-7-year-old kid, I wasn't really given a lot of choice, you know. I remember being driven around one night by the two of them, and they said, you know, that we were going to be adopted, and that my mom wanted us all to be baptized. And I was the holdout, you know. For me, it was, didn't really want to be baptized, didn't really want to take my stepdad's name. My brother was more willing but my older brother, Glenn, he was from a previous marriage, my mother's previous marriage, so my dad wasn't even his dad, so I guess he was kind of getting used to this by that time, so he was he was more willing. But I do remember, so it was a difficult transition as a, you know, 7-year-old kid, because there were things about Mormonism that I really liked. You know, as I mentioned, we were Pentecostal, so that was mostly my religious experience up to that point. Was my grandmother, who I love dearly, is very, very devoted, very devout Pentecostal woman. And so as a child, that was the church that we went to. And it was interesting because it was always, I never felt comfortable in that community.
In
the Pentecostal community. And it's hard to describe except as a, I think just, you know, it was very much a holy roller kind of church, you know, a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of singing, a lot of dancing, a lot of people speaking in tongues, and the, you know, the preachers, very charismatic preachers, and they were, you know, lay their hands on people's heads and people would be out of control, you know. And as a child, that just scared the hell out of me. I didn't feel the spirit, or if that was the spirit, I didn't want anything to do with it. You know, it was like, it just never made me comfortable. To see my grandfather, who, you know, had health problems, and he was such a calm, quiet, dignified man, but then to see him at church, and he would get up and he would, you know, be filled with the spirit, and he'd be dancing and shouting, and it was actually kind of terrifying for a little kid. And so I never felt comfortable. In fact, there was one time, my older brother decided at one point that he wanted to be a preacher, and told my mother and grandmother, and of course they were telling everybody in the church that Glenn wanted, you know, Butch, he was known by Butch at that point, he wanted to be a preacher, and everybody thought that was so wonderful, and they asked me if I wanted to be a preacher. And I remember, you know, I can't remember the response, but it was the 7-year-old's equivalent of, hell no, I want nothing to do with this, you know. So it was interesting, though, when Harold Dutcher took us to the Mormon church, Mormon services, I actually pretty immediately took to it, because I think it really agreed.
Wasn't quite as scary, for one thing.
And it kind of agreed with my personality, and I'm much more, a little more introverted. I think I'm a little bit more of a thinker. And so there was a lot in Mormonism that I really responded to. You know, it was like people were, you know, there wasn't any, the singing was pretty calm, the meetings didn't get too crazy at all, and everything was just very calm and kind of intellectual, you know, and there's a lot of book reading and talking, and I really, you know, I really liked it, so I really responded well. And plus the whole Joseph Smith story, which is, you know, for a young boy, it's like it's such a perfect story. And so I really, you know, kind of thought, well, this is, you know, Joseph Smith, he was this pioneer kid, and at 14 he saw Jesus and God, and he built this church, and he had a big city, and then he got shot and killed, and to me it was just like, this is the most wonderful story ever, so I'm in, you know. And so I really did find a spiritual home in Mormonism. It was a good place for me.
Yeah, you did. And we'll talk kind of in one of our segments about your whole spiritual journey, and I'll maybe ask you more questions about, you know, this, whatever your spiritual core self is like and things like that. But somewhere along the line, obviously, from this initial hesitation, you ended up going on a mission, an LDS mission. Can you tell us where you served and,
yeah, sure,
and maybe
actually,
some
probably,
key experiences there?
So go ahead. A few other things we should fill in before that. I do remember I wasn't too happy with Harold Dutcher at the beginning. or at the end. The midpoint was okay. But there, so when I finally agreed to be baptized, when my mother and brother were baptized, I think 6 or 8 months before I was, and I think the reason, besides my reluctance, was I don't think I'd turned 8 years old yet. So they did it, and when it came to be my turn to be baptized, I didn't want Dutcher to baptize me because, you know, to me he was still basically an interloper. You know, here's this guy came along, he's not my dad, wants to be my dad, anyway. And so I agreed to be baptized, but I wanted one of the missionaries to baptize me. And so there was one of the missionaries. His name was Elder Dalton, who was one of the missionaries in Mount Vernon.
The reason, fill in for those who don't know, well, why that name it comes up later.
Right. And so kind of in as a way to honor that or remember him, honor him, this Elder Dalton, I named the character that I played in the film God's Army, I named it him Elder Dalton. So that's where that reference comes from. But growing up in Mormonism, you know, like I say, it really pretty much worked for me. I went through a period of kind of rebellion around 16, you know, 16 to 18, where I wasn't active, and but it was far different than what came along later. You know, it was basically just, you know, rebellion, misbehavior, and experimenting, having some fun. But even at that point, it was never I never had any issues or questions about the truthfulness of the church. It was just I was 16 and wanted to misbehave, and so, but then at about 18, 19, I started to, you know, examine my life, take things seriously, and start to realize that, you know, I wanted to be a spiritual man. I wanted to be a man of God, and so I knew that I was mission bound eventually. There's another story there. I don't know how much to tell because I don't want to bore people to death, but the another way that movies came into play in this was when I was 18, and this had been a couple years of inactivity at the time. And I was struggling with this. Even though I was inactive, I had a mission in the back of my mind. And I thought, as an adult man, of course, I would be an active Mormon and I'd have a Mormon family. But nobody could really get to me as far as getting me to become active again and start doing the things, you know, going to church and all that stuff. But, and so nobody, you know, young men's leaders or friends or family, whoever, couldn't really get through to me. And then, oddly enough, I was in St. George because I was working in Arizona, Jacob Lake, Arizona. And so I was in St. George watching the new Star Wars movie at that time, which would have been, what would this have been, 1983. So it would have been, what, Return of the Jedi? Empire Strikes Back. I can never remember which one it was.
Well, that's the second one is Empire, and the third one is, yeah.
So. Well, whichever one it is that has Luke Skywalker, and he's in the wherever he is, the Death Star, wherever it is, and I guess it's the new Death Star, I guess, but he's in between the evil Emperor and Darth Vader, and, you know, he knows that Darth Vader's his father, and what's he going to choose? Is he going to choose, you know, to follow his father, or, and so, to me, and that really, you know, surprising. I went into a movie theater just thinking I was going to have fun, but I found myself so emotionally moved by this because I kind of felt the same way. You know, my own father, who I hadn't seen at this time in, you know, since I was 7 years old. So, you know, this has been 11 years since I'd seen my own real father. And so I really resonated with this, you know, the dark father trying to get him to go to the dark side. And then you've got, you know, him wanting to, what's he going to choose? And I really, it really hit me hard and was very emotionally moving. And it was in the car after that, driving back home, that it really sank in, that I really realized that, okay, I have to choose the good side. You know, I have to choose the right. I have to go on a mission. I have to do this. So I always joke that it was you know, when nobody could get to me, when Spencer Kimball or at the top to Sunday school teachers at the bottom, nobody could reach me. It turned out George Lucas was the one that got to me. And so I largely
definitely
credit.
Return of the Jedi is the scenes you've.
That's what it was.
Yeah,
okay.
So.
So I definitely credit George Lucas for sending me on a mission.
had you done any student films or messed with video cameras or filmed little snippets and things up through this period?
Yeah, I loved. Always loved film, and so I wasn't like, you know, I wasn't like Spielberg, who, at least according to legend, you know, was always shooting stuff with his Super 8. But yeah, my stepfather had a Super 8 camera, and so I would shoot. I remember shooting stuff as a little kid. And then I was looking for it recently, and it apparently has been lost. So so I did that. I had a friend in high school. We did some stuff. And I was very involved in theater as an actor in high school. You know, tried to stay as busy as I could there. And then also in other things. I did my first semi-professional play when I was about 14, shortly after we moved to Salt Lake City. And I went up to Promise Valley Playhouse and auditioned for the Christmas Carol and did that. And I was taking lessons, acting lessons at Theater 138, which was right about a block away from Promise Valley. And that was a great time. But that's an interesting thing, and I should mention that too, is like I knew, as I mentioned, I knew since I was very young that I wanted to make films. Didn't know exactly how that would happen or what role, you know, I would fall into. But definitely loved acting, loved performing, and so when I decided I really needed to be serious about this at 14, I remember going to my stepfather and my mother and saying, hey, I need to take these acting lessons and I want to audition for this play. And I don't know, it was probably more a financial thing. They probably didn't have the money. But you know, they were about as unsupportive as you could possibly be, as in I couldn't even get a ride to the theater. You know, if I was going to do this, I was going to have to get on the bus. And we lived at about State Street and about 8,000 South. And so I'd ride that bus, you know, back and forth. But when I couldn't get any money, and my brother, Glenn, my older brother, saw that that's what I wanted to do, he actually stepped up and put up the money for me to be able to take these acting classes and then, you know, get the bus so I could go down for rehearsals for this play. So so he was very supportive, and I probably wouldn't have been able to do that if it wasn't for him.
Well, neat. Well, I'd love to have you tell us just at least a little bit about your mission, and we can, you know, revisit it as if any themes from it made its way into films, or we can we can explore it again a little bit more when we talk more about your own spiritual journey and stuff like that. But where did you serve? Tell us all those kinds of details.
Well, I remember by the time I was ready to serve, I was very humbled. You know, I was getting my life in order, you know, and so I was very humble and and it was an irony because I was willing to go anywhere. I really wanted to go to France. I thought, for some reason, I just wanted to be Paris. I thought would be the mission that I should be in.
Artistic temperament. Yeah.
And so when people would always ask me, as they ask everybody, you know, it's like, where do you want to go? And just jokingly, I would always say, I want to go anywhere except Mexico. And I would say that just, without fail. I want to go anywhere except Mexico, because I really did not want to go to Mexico. Mexico seemed like, you know, the armpit of the world. I didn't want to go. and when I got the, when I received the envelope, you know, to tell me where I was going to go, I actually went into my room, closed the door, and sat on the edge of the bed, and I just knew it. I was like, I didn't even need to really open it. I just knew, somehow I just knew, it's Mexico. I'm going to Mexico. And so I said a little prayer saying, I'll go anywhere, you know, I'm good, whatever it is. I opened it up, sure enough, you're called to Veracruz, Mexico. And it was actually pretty funny. But, yeah, it was a great mission. It really, really was. I mean, it was quite an adventure. It was, turned out to be the perfect mission for me. I think I would have hated Paris, actually, because in Mexico you actually got to teach people and you actually, you know, got to... got to help people. And so, but it was a fantastic mission. I had a great mission president, a lot of great experiences. I was thrown into prison in Mexico, just after I'd only been there a couple of months. And my companion and I were walking down the street in Oaxaca, Mexico. And this guy with a gun came up and just, you know, stopped us and immediately, you know, was asking for our papers and this kind of stuff. And he arrested me. I didn't know this, but there was a law that no foreign-born person can be a minister or priest in Mexico. And this was the result of, you know, all the foreigners coming in and, you know, taking over their religion. But anyway, so I was led, you know, at gunpoint to a jail in Oaxaca, Mexico, and it was nasty.
Was your companion a North American too, or well, I guess Mexican? Was he native Mexican?
Yeah, my companion was okay. Mexican, okay, so he was, you know, he wasn't under arrest, and so he, of course, immediately as they took me into the jail, he ran off to, you know, tell the mission president that Elder Dutcher had just been put in jail.
Hermano.
Yeah, that's right. No, it was Elder.
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 Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so. And it was the coolest experience. I mean, everybody was so worked up about it. They thought, and it was a nasty jail. I mean, just absolutely. You think of a Mexican jail, and this was worse. It was, you know, there were like 16 of us crammed into this room that was probably just a little bit bigger than the room that we're in right now, and it had one toilet, you know, in the corner which wasn't working. It had overflowed like 3 days before, and so it just reeked, and it was just concrete, dirty concrete, and a little concrete ledge, and the bars that, you know, look out into the courtyard where they had trees, where it looked like they performed executions, and and so I'm there, and of course, as soon as the word gets out, the members start coming to the, you know, coming to bring things, you know, and they bring me a Book of Mormon that I actually used as a pillow because I needed something to use as a pillow. And they started bringing food, and I'd already decided that I was going to fast, so they'd bring food, and I would pass it out to the other prisoners, so I became kind of popular. And then I got to know them and talk to them, and there was a guy who was in for raping a woman, and a guy who just robbed, and a guy who had gotten drunk and broken something. I can't remember what it was. Anyway, we got, you know, it was got to know each other a little bit, but they couldn't believe that I was in there for that. You know, one of the guys I remember is asking me, what are you in for? And I said, well, I'm a missionary, and he said, I remember saying, a missionary who did what? And I said, no, I'm American, and apparently I'm not supposed to be a missionary here. And they never did believe it. They knew that I'd done something, but then I wasn't admitting it. But as soon as I started giving them food, then they started showing me little tricks about how to stay warm at night, because, you know, we took newspapers, and it actually does work as a really great insulator. So put the newspapers underneath and over, had the Book of Mormon as a pillow, and had a pretty good night's sleep. But I do remember, you know, getting up in the morning and I'm at the bars, you know, looking out, and I remember feeling great. You know, it was like, wow, I'm getting to experience this. You know, this is what Joseph Smith and the Apostle Paul, and this is, yeah, you know, this is the experience.
You're already composing your own letters that will become scripture someday, right?
So I was just having a great time, and while I was there, of course, the whole, you know, the mission president had called Salt Lake, who had called, you know, Mexico City, and they had some arrangement, and of course they had to work everything out. So I had to, they shipped me off to Mexico City, and everything worked out. behind the
scenes.
So
you had to change missions. So you,
no, I didn't have to change missions. I just had to leave. And, the church leaders were speaking with the Mexico leader, the officials in Mexico City, the government, and so they worked it out, and I was released. And I was allowed to go back to the mission, but I wasn't allowed to... they just said, go back, keep a low profile, you know, which was fine. But, you know, in Mexico, they don't... That's the reason they don't... We never wore name tags in Mexico, because I think we were kind of not supposed to really be there, but we were. But anyway, there's an interesting postscript to that story, which was, it turns out I was thrown in jail just because the local magistrate, the chief of police, whatever you'd call him, you know, he saw an American and thought he'd throw me in jail and he could get some money out of it because, you know, they operate largely on bribes down there. And so he just thought, you know, the American, throw him in, they'll be able to get, you know, some money and be done with it. But it didn't work out that way. And about a year, about a little over a year later, I was the mission accountant, and so I would drive around the mission checking up on the books and taking care of things. And I went through Oaxaca, and just out of curiosity, you know, I went back to the family that we were the closest to while we were staying there and asked about, and they said, did you hear about this man? I forget his name now. I remember very distinctly what he looked like. You remember that when you're thrown into jail at gunpoint. But he they asked if I knew what had happened. I said no. And apparently he had been busted just a couple months before, some kind of corruption or whatever. And he was then in prison, but for going to be in there for quite a long time. And I remember feeling, you know, at the time, you know, just feeling like, well, that's what happens when you mess with the Lord's anointed. But interesting. Yeah, it was an interesting experience. But that was one experience in a mission that was really great. I had a great mission president, Jack Beecroft, and his wife, Marilyn. They were just the most wonderful and amazing people. Great friendships that, you know, continue still, and a lot of success as a missionary as far as teaching and baptizing and, some really, really wonderful experiences. So it's something I've never regretted doing.
Right. And obviously made some movies based upon the missionary experience writ large and some neat themes. When we get to the movies, if anything from your mission, you know,
okay,
raises its consciousness for that, we'll move on. So you came home from a mission. Had you done some college prior to your mission? At what point did, you know, education in that track?
Yeah, I'd done a year at BYU before my mission.
Okay.
And I'd chosen BYU simply because they had offered the largest scholarship, and I was dead broke. You know, so.
The largest scholarship for film or academics?
No,
or
it was for leadership, I think, because in the high school I was student body vice president and doing the plays and editor of the school newspaper. And so I had a few offers. University of Utah and Utah State had offered scholarships, but BYU had offered the biggest one. And so I went to BYU not out of, you know, any kind of religious loyalty. It was just pure, you know, pure
economics.
Greed.
Yeah. Well, good, man. Free school is the way to go. As free as you can make it. That's
yeah,
sure.
Exactly. So I did a year there, and then afterwards worked for a little while, and then went back out to Utah. I left from Kansas City as a missionary. That's where my parents were living at the time. Actually, they were separated or getting a divorce at the time I left. And so I served my mission. This is actually kind of a funny story, where a girl I started liking right before I left Kansas City, and it was one of the things where she was really cute, and she was, I just really liked her, and I started to regret. It's like, well, maybe I shouldn't have gone on this mission. But I left, and, you know, we wrote a little bit in between. My parents divorced while I was on my mission, and then my stepdad stayed in near Kansas City, and my mother went to Georgia. And by the time the mission was over, when I went back to Kansas City, my stepfather had married this girl's mother.
Oh,
and
wow.
So she was actually the mother and the girl that I had been kind of falling in love with were living in the same house. And so it was a little interesting as a, you know, an immediately returned missionary to be, go home and there's a new stepmother, and the girl that I had been, you know, really liking was now sleeping in the room right next to mine. And so I decided I probably shouldn't stay in Kansas too long.
And spiritual
so,
giant you.
Yeah, so I was only there for a few months. And then I went to Georgia and spent a few months there. And then, you know, had made enough money that I was able to go to Utah and start school again.
So at BYU, are you majoring immediately in film or theater and cinematic arts or whatever the major was called? Or what?
Oh, yeah, it was always film.
Always,
it was
okay.
Always, yeah, whatever I could get film-wise. And I know you'd been interested in when I decided to be an independent filmmaker. I think that really gelled for me immediately. It was right after the mission where, you know, all this time I knew I wanted to make films. I didn't quite know how to go about it. And when I was in Georgia after my mission, I was actually at a bookstore looking through the film section, and I found this one book. It was just called Independent Filmmaking, and it was some guy named Gregory Goodell, I think, something like that. But it looked like a really good book, so I picked it up, and I took it, sat down at a Wendy's. I remember sitting down at a Wendy's and starting to read this book, and it was this man explaining how independent filmmaking worked as opposed to studio filmmaking. And I just instantly, it was like, oh, this is it. This is it. You know, this is exactly where I should be. And so I just started devouring that and anything else I could get on filmmaking, and then went out to BYU. And BYU was an interesting experience. This was in the 80s, you know, the later part of the 80s was when I was there. And it was interesting. The film school was very interesting in the sense that after I was there about a year, I started to think maybe I was wasting my time, that what I really should do is just pack up and go to L.A., because we would learn a lot about film history, a lot of film criticism, film theory, saw a lot of old films as long as they had no nudity or anything, you know, profanity or anything in them, so we missed a lot of great films. But I got to the point, there was a couple things that happened. One of them was I was starting to realize that people were graduating who knew nothing about filmmaking. I mean, they knew, again, they could go teach a course on the history of film, but they didn't know how to make a film at all. And it wasn't even required. You could graduate in film and not have made a film. You could if you wanted to, but you didn't have to. And also, there was one of the instructors who was making, you know, he'd make his films on the side, and one day he invited us all to come watch the film that he had just finished. It was a short film, and I remember being all excited because this is the guy that taught us, you know, a lot of screenwriting, and he was one of the main instructors. And so sat down to watch this thing, and I was appalled. It was awful. I mean, you could look at it, I mean, from cinematography to writing to acting to just the whole thing was just awful.
So given his budget, he could have done better. Much better. It's not just production values.
Not just production values.
Just the whole thing was...
No. Yeah. It just seemed completely devoid of...
Interesting.
And so I was worried. And I went to the head of the department at the time, whose name was Charles Metten, and sat down with him and just said... And he had known me as an actor, mostly, because I'd done a lot of acting.
Had you been in BYU Productions as an actor? Okay.
Yeah. And so we sat down, and it was a really memorable conversation because I was telling him my concerns. I said, look, I want to leave BYU with my bachelor's degree and know how to make a movie, you know, be able to make an independent film, start to finish. This is what I want out of my education, and I don't think I'm going to get it. And he's like, no, you'll be good. And and I remember saying something to him. You know, again, he only knew me as an actor. We'd never had any other film classes together. But he was kind of, and he was telling me that I should go, instead of being a producer, I should go into wardrobe or go into makeup or go into, you know, one of the supporting fields in film. And I was telling him, no, I'm going to be a writer and a director. And I even said, I can't believe you're even telling me, without knowing me, you're recommending that I go do this. I could be Orson Welles sitting here, and you wouldn't, you know, and you're telling me to go do makeup. And he actually said to me, he said, you're not Orson Welles. And he says, if you were Orson Welles, I would know it. And I was thinking, well, how the hell would you know? Because you've never seen anything that I've done. So I remember I walked out, but I thought, okay, well, I'm going to stay. I'm not married, you know, and I'm going to give this everything I've got. and put the next time in, did a lot of great shows. BYU, again, was another wonderful experience. It was just, had a lot of great friends, mostly in the theater department instead of in the film department. But had a, and had some great instructors. Tad Danielewski was probably the most influential teacher I've had, mostly as an actor. But it was, again, a situation where I was about to graduate, and I realized that I didn't know how to... I realized that Charles Metten had... and I really liked the man, so I'm not bagging on Charles Metten, but he... obviously, he wasn't a filmmaker, so he didn't really know what it was that I needed to know. And that's the problem with film schools, is you're being taught by people who don't make films, you know? So how are they going to teach you how to make films when they don't really know how to do it themselves? And the people who do know how to do it aren't at schools. They're out there doing it.
Do you sense this has gotten better since the time you were there?
So you're
saying this is endemic to many film programs, not just BYU.
Oh, yeah, most. Okay. Most, if not, there's a few exceptions. You know, if you're looking at, Southern California schools where they actually have professionals who are, working and teaching at the same time. But most places, no, you're being taught screenwriting by people who have never...
sold a screenplay.
Yeah. Some of them never, I would say, probably have never actually written a screenplay.
Wow.
And certainly never sold one, and 100 years from actually having one produced, which makes no sense, And you're being taught directing by people who don't know how to direct. Sometimes you're being taught film directing by people who direct plays on the stage at the college, and that doesn't help. And you're being taught acting by unemployed actors. Anyway, it's just that kind of a thing. So I think people should really understand that when they go into a film school is, even though you're still going to have to largely be self-taught, mm-hmm. And
now, I know at some point you did associate with the BYU Mormon Picture Studio. I know you were in some church films. Is that during this period or that's later?
That was just as an actor. I would go, okay. It was not at all associated with BYU. I just had an agent in Salt Lake City. And so whenever the church would be doing a production, I'd go up and audition for it. And so I got cast in a couple of those things.
But you're there, you're acting, but are you soaking up the art of making the film? Are you watching the directors? You're watching all the different parts of it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But again, where I really learned to make films wasn't in... What I really got out of BYU was... Well, I learned a lot about Frank Capra. They love Frank Capra there. So I learned a lot of history. I saw a lot of great films that I would never have seen and was introduced to a lot of great filmmakers that I never would have known about. But as far as the filmmaking goes, where I really learned was I started devouring videos. There's a little video store that was right. There's a little Thai restaurant where it is now. It's just south of campus. It was on my way home. And I would just every day, rent a movie or two, and I would hit the movie theaters as often as I could. And I got in the habit of kind of watching some, if I saw a film that I could tell was really well done, I would, I'd watch it three times. I'd watch it without the sound so I could just look at the images, how the director was creating these images, how it was all edited together. And then, like I said, a couple months before I graduated, I realized that I was about to graduate and I didn't know how to really do it. And so it was... I remember there was some equipment available, and so I went and I checked out the equipment, and I went out and just basically using the book, that book that I had bought before, right after my mission, that had kind of talked about the entire process of raising money through finishing and selling a film. I basically used that as my education, and I went out and tried to raise money from whomever I could to make a short film, a little 10-minute film, but it would be film, it'd be shot on film. The whole thing, I would do the whole process just as if it were a long film. It would just be 10 minutes. And so that was called, it was called Brother John, and it was a fun little idea. I thought it would be really creative, and it was unique. And so that's what I did. I was able to raise, I think it was $3,500, and that was enough to buy the film stock. And I was, the school let me use the equipment for free. And so yeah, I just threw it together and started acting like a movie producer, and it's like I hired people to come on be my crew, and I cast it, and And then I finished it, you know, edited it myself, finished it, went to the lab and did all the work, the sound work. And and so when I graduated, I left with this 10-minute film, and I left knowing how to make a film. And if I hadn't done it, I would have been fit to probably teach Film History 101, but not know how to make it. And so right after that, I started continued writing screenplays, trying to get things done. And then we hung around, my wife and I hung around Provo for about another year, and then we packed up our little Plymouth Horizon and went to L.A. But
good. I wanted to loop back. You mentioned your wife. It's Gwen Dutcher.
Yeah.
Fill us in on, you know, your meeting her and courtship, and at what point in relation to film school and all that.
And the great romance.
Did it work? Yeah.
There. Yeah. I met Gwen at BYU. She was an art student who also did a lot of acting. And she claims that we met once before I remember meeting her, but she claims that there's a place called The Slab in the Harris Fine Arts Center. I think it's on the north end of the building? And it's on the main floor, and all the students congregate there because there's a big marble slab or whatever. And she claims that we met there, that a mutual friend, actually the girl I was dating at the time, introduced us. And she's probably right, but I like the story better telling it my way, which is we were at an audition. And there's a little prologue to this. She had actually seen me do a few plays where I was playing. She didn't, and one was Star Spangled Girl, and one was, I think it was Born Yesterday, and another one was Thieves or something like this. Herb Gardner's Thieves, and I was playing such diverse characters that she'd seen all three of these plays and liked these three actors, didn't realize it was the same guy. And so when she had seen Star Spangled Girl, this was before she knew me, and I love this part of the story because it complements my ego. But I guess in the
isn't
class.
Isn't that why we marry our wives? Yeah, they make us feel good about ourselves.
Yeah.
At first, at least.
And then she, you know, she got up in class and just was talking about Richard Dutcher and that he was a genius. And then she confessed that to me later, and I really like that story. But I didn't know her, and I hadn't seen her in anything. And I went to an audition for a graduate school play, an Ibsen play. It was Ghosts. And they were doing the audition in this room in the Harris Fine Arts Center. It was like on the fourth floor. It's now been turned into some art rooms, I think, where they opened it up and do some art. I checked in recently, just the romantic, you know, revisiting these important places of the past. But it was a room, and the director was kind of holding the audition in the middle of the room, which was kind of weird. So, you know, he had people on one side of the room, people on the other side, and she was doing these auditions right there. And so I came in a little bit late. The auditions were already going, and I sat down with a friend of mine. His name was Joe. And waiting for my turn to audition, and I was looking across, and my girlfriend at the time, whose name was Veronique, was talking to this girl. And I was just instantly captivated by this girl because there was just something so wonderful about her to me. She was so, I mean, she's pretty, but she was just so, there was just this loving kind of energy, this goodness that was just so apparent, you know, in the way that she spoke and carried herself. And I was, instead of reading the lines, you know, and getting ready for my audition, I just kept watching her because she was just so interesting. And I leaned over to the guy at Joe who was with me, and I said, "Who is that girl that's talking to Veronique?" And he said, I don't know. And I watched her some more, and then I leaned over again, and I said, "I'm going to marry that girl." And he thought I was, you know, he just thought that was me being me. But no, I was really, it was like I just instantly recognized that she was the woman that I wanted to marry.
We're not cueing Saturday's Warrior music at this point.
No.
I've seen that smile somewhere before.
No, it wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't at all
your soul is
right. No, I didn't recognize her from a previous life or anything. But I recognized that she was the kind of woman that I wanted to be with. You know, that there, that there was that love. And I mean, I could instantly see, and I've told my children this, you know, it's like one of the things I instantly saw about her was that she'd be a great mother. You know, you could just tell by how loving she was and how good she was that she would be an amazing mother, and she has been. And so, and that to me was very important, because I've always, oddly, even though my own childhood was kind of messed up, yeah. With the divorces and the neglect and abuse and weird stuff, it's kind of odd that I grew up wanting a large family, but I definitely did. And I immediately saw in this young woman that she had the qualities that would be a great mother, and she was pretty. And so I just started dating her. And there's another fun part of that story, which was as soon as I had, of course, she was talking to my girlfriend at the time, and they were pretty good friends, turns out. And so I'm out with my girlfriend a couple nights later, and I just mentioned Gwen. She's like, oh, do you want to drop in? Gwen was living at the little dorms just to the east of campus there. What do they call it, Helaman Halls or something like that?
Or Heritage, one of them. Yeah,
Heritage, just where the women were, right? So went over there. It was late at night, and Gwen was there. Went up to her room, you know, and then the kitchen part. And so Veronique and I are kissing on the couch, on their couch, while Gwen's sitting on the end of the couch kind of talking to us as we're making out. And then eventually Veronique falls asleep. And so I'm there with Veronique and Gwen sitting on the edge of the couch, and I start talking to Gwen, have a really good conversation while my girlfriend's asleep. And I just immediately knew. It's like I even knew before. I just knew that it was like, this is the woman that I want to be with. So now how do I get out of this relationship and into that relationship? And it wasn't very difficult, you know, because Veronique, of course, could see that that something was going on. So Veronique and I went out to dinner one night. Where was it? It's like Skipper's or something like that. And we had this, you know, talk, and she said, it's okay if you want to date Veronique. I mean, if you want to date Gwen. And I said, okay, well, maybe I'll do that. And so then I take her home, drop her off, and immediately go find Gwen. And then Gwen and I go park up that night. I stopped and got some Nutter Butters from 7-Eleven and a gallon of milk, and then we went and parked up at Provo Temple and just made out all night long. So in the morning, she had to be in class at like 8 o'clock, so we get done making, you know, we're there all night, just kissing and making out all night long. I drive her to class, and she goes in, and she's got beard burn on her face from making out all night, and she's exhausted, but she goes, staggers in, sits down next to Veronique, and Veronique leans over and says, I talked to Richard last night, and it's okay if you want to go out with him. So,
okay, good.
But it took
on. And you're just talking razor, you couldn't have been wearing a beard at BYU at this time.
No, so it was just, yeah.
Just the stubble from
the 5 o'clock
the
shadow or whatever.
Okay,
from
good.
Getting at her. But, we were just inseparable from then on, and we got married not too long after that. We were going to get married right away. This was like October, November when we started really dating. I proposed right before I left to go back to St. Louis, where my mother had then moved for Christmas. And so I was up at the restaurant in Sundance and proposed. And she said yes. And then later, I proposed again on the stage at BYU of the play that we were doing, which was called The Foreigner. And she said yes again. And then I proposed like 3 or 4 times, and she always said yes. It's just that I always, in my life, there was all these places that I wanted to propose.
Oh, very cool.
And so we just kept doing it, and she kept saying yes, luckily. And then I got back from Christmas, and we were going to elope. We were going to it was like, I was ready, and you know, I was ready to go. This time I was almost 24, and really, really wanted to be married.
for various reasons.
Yeah, and
some spiritual, some not.
Yeah, mostly not at that point. So we were going to elope, and we were all ready to do it, and we'd gone to the courthouse, and she was 18, so we were legal. We could do this if we wanted to. And then I suggested, you know, we should just let your parents know that we're getting married, because I don't want to start off on the wrong foot, you know. And she said, I don't know if that's a good idea, but I said, I think it'd be smart if we, you know, if we do this right. So she calls her parents, and it's just chaos, you know. As soon as she says, I'm getting married, and her mother says, you are not. She says, yes, I am. When are you getting married? Tomorrow. You are not. It just explodes, you know, and you've got, I mean, it's something that I do want to film someday because I was hearing the conversation as she was talking, and I could actually hear her mother wailing, and I could hear her father on the phone saying, "Look what you're doing to your mother." And, you know, and it was just going badly. And so they wanted to talk to me, and I got on the phone, and this was my first conversation with them.
Where they live?
They lived in Wisconsin, Madison, okay, Wisconsin. That's where Gwen grew up.
Okay.
And it was, it wasn't the best start because I basically just said, "I understand, but I'm marrying her anyway. And so, you know, just get used to the idea." And that's pretty much how it was left. And then we walked around in the snow and it was, you know, we're talking about it. And I finally said, "All right, well, let's just wait a few months, and then in the springtime, they can come out, and we can do a wedding, and if that's really important to everybody, then let's just do that." And, you know, I felt like I'd just concede this point, you know, what's a few months, we can do this, you know. And so that's what we did. We decided, okay, we won't elope, we're going to get married, you know, in April, as soon as the spring rolls around, and but ultimately, it didn't make any difference. They weren't any happier in April than they would have been in January.
So you're both at BYU, but somehow or other, the temple doesn't seem to be a goal for the marriage.
No, this is an interesting part of the story.
Where does this come in?
First of all, let me jump ahead a little bit because we had the best wedding ever in the sense that we wanted to get married outside. There's an outdoor theater up near Sundance, Aspen Grove, Stone Theater, and we loved it. And so we decided we're going to get married there. And so we just, and again, we didn't really have even permission to get married up there. We tried, but they couldn't give it to us for whatever reason. But they just said, "Just show up and do it, and who's going to care?" So that's what we did. You know, we just planned it all, and it happened to snow the night before our wedding. It was in late April, April 22nd. And so in the morning, and her family is completely uncooperative, and my family is completely absent, you know, because that's just my family. And so I'm there. And my best friend, one of my best friends, Daryl, who I'd met in the mission field, and we're there with snow shovels in the morning, you know, scooping out the theater so that we can do our wedding. And we've got, and Gwen, of course, her family's not helping out, so she's running around getting the flowers and things for the wedding. And it was basically just a wedding that she and I threw. And as miserable as it kind of was at the time, it was, you know, it's great. It was our wedding. We did it. Nobody wanted us to get married, and we did it anyway. And everybody was negative, you know, it's like they're all saying, "Oh, this isn't going to last 18 months," which I have no idea why they would say that, except that, you know, people are that way. And so, but it was a great wedding, and the only bad part was of the entire wedding, well, everybody's bitching about it, of course, when they get there and there's snow, and to Gwen and I, it was just romantic. It was, here's our wedding, and we're in a beautiful stone theater, and it wasn't all that cold, but there was snow around, and it was in the mountains and the pine trees, and a clear day. It was just beautiful. You know, it was just amazing. And the only downside was the bishop, our bishop at the time, who was doing the ceremony, who of course took the time to lecture us, you know, during the, and I gave him the evil. I mean, he started into this, you know, it's like a year from now, this couple, you know, they should go to the temple, and I just gave him the nastiest, dirtiest look. And he actually stopped, I think, when he looked at me and saw the Clint Eastwood look I was giving him. It was like, okay. And so he kind of backed away, but I always thought, come on, man, this is my wedding.
Yeah.
And, you know, lecture Sunday. Don't do this now. And anyway, beautiful wedding. It was absolutely beautiful. And we got in the car, drove away, and went to St. George for our very meager honeymoon. We only had a few days, but we went running around seeing ghost towns and old movie sites in St. George. It was just a wonderful thing. And there's an old town called Perea, I think it was called. They shot The Outlaw Josie Wales there. And anyway, we made love outside the saloon in Perea in the middle of the day in the desert. It was great. It was great. Now everybody who goes to Perea is going to go, "Ew, there's the saloon, ew." But it was fantastic. But there is a good story here because, yeah, after my mission, I went through another period of inactivity, which was more because I became so focused on my career at this point. And I just found myself drifting away. And I didn't really, the BYU, environment wasn't really conducive to me. I was always a really good Mormon when I was not in Utah. And then, but something about, I think I just have a kind of a nonconformist personality. And so there's something about when I'm in a group and everyone's doing something, I want to do something else. Always. It's always been that way. If there's a group, I go in the opposite direction. And I think that was kind of at play, psychologically probably at play, as I was inactive at BYU. But when it came time and I knew that it was time for me to get married, and I always held the temple I always had a real sacred feeling towards the temple. I'd had some great experiences in the temple, and it had always been very sacred to me. And so I didn't feel like I wasn't necessarily unworthy. I mean, I certainly hadn't done anything, and Gwen and I hadn't done anything that, you know, wouldn't take a few weeks of repenting and behaving ourselves to be fine going to the temple. And I had plenty of friends who, you know, from the mission field who had completely, you know, sexually had a field day and still gone to the temple. But I just didn't, to me, that wasn't it. You know, it was like the temple was a sacred thing, and I'd been inactive, and I didn't feel like it was, I just didn't feel like, I'm not going to just whip things into shape in 6 weeks and go to the temple. That just felt cheap and wrong to me. So I just said, let's just get married. I mean, it's a big deal, no big deal. Let's just get married. Then in a year we'll get married in the temple. And Gwen was fine with that. But it was interesting because instantly everyone just assumed, of course, that we were having sex, and it wasn't the case at all. But I didn't care if they thought that. You know, besides I was 24, and it was like, if people wanted to think that, it's like, all right.
Well, I've seen you and Gwen together, and you guys are an amazing couple, and you have 7 children together now.
7 kids.
Never looked back. And some of the people who we may not remember to do it in God's Army, Gwen is in a very brief scene in God's Army for those
right,
who want to know.
God's Army, yeah. She's the character that my character baptizes in the ocean. So
yeah,
that's
so if
Gwen.
You see this blonde woman, you're there or, for 5 seconds of film or something, that's Gwen.
Yeah, but the temple thing was important. And then we did marry in the temple about a year and a half after our civil. And interestingly, that marriage, I hardly even remember that. It was just, you know, but our wedding in the outdoor theater in Aspen Grove was just beautiful, and it was perfect, and especially considering how things have evolved spiritually for me, I'm so very glad that I was married in the mountains of Utah.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to discuss it with others, please check us out online at mormonstories.org. If you want to find other friends, family members, former missionary companions, or ward members who approach Mormonism like you, consider adding me, John DeLynn, as your Facebook friend. This may seem like a strange idea, but many of my closest friends have discovered that they are not alone in their thoughts or feelings or family or even ward situation through discovering mutual Facebook friends. Finally, to keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider a donation at mormonstories.org. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Nearer, my God, to thee, nearer to thee, even though it be across the heavens and me, still